This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hearings today before the Senate Judiciary Committee on President Bush's domestic surveillance program. The logistical nuts and bolts, as far as they are known, are all about AT&T, MCI, Sprint, and maybe others tapping government spies into international calls said to be monitored for terrorist connections, and the government doing that in secret with no warrants. The constitutional issues are as big as they get. War powers, civil liberties, when, if ever, the president can, as critics contend, ignore the law, and when and if the Congress will call him to account. Up next on Point, we listen in on the hearing's launch and weigh the big issues boiling around the surveillance going on right now. Joining me now from Washington to help set up today's hearings is John Diamond, Washington correspondent for USA Today. John, thanks very much for being with us.
Great, Tom.
What's the tenor of the opening of these hearings today, the very beginning of it, John?
Contentious right from the get-go. There was a delay in starting of the testimony over the question of whether the Attorney General Gonzalez should be sworn in. Chairman Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, made a ruling of the chair that he should not be, that the committee precedent was for sitting cabinet officers not to have to take an oath before testimony. Democrats objected, especially Senator Feingold of Wisconsin. His issue is that he believes that Gonzalez has been untruthful in previous testimony in some of his answers to questions regarding presidential powers, torture of prisoners in the war on terrorism, and so forth, and feels that it is essential that he be sworn in today so that the testimony essentially occur under the same sort of guidelines. There was a partisan, a party-line vote of the committee supporting Specter's ruling. Gonzalez then started testimony without having been sworn in and said, of course, that he would have agreed to be sworn had it been so ruled. But he also said his testimony would have been the same either way.
So contention right from the start. John, describe for us what is at stake here. The Senate's looking into this. So as far as we know, the Judiciary Committee is going to do this for one day, maybe more, but there's one day scheduled. What might come out of these hearings?
It's a really good question because it's not really clear that anything could come out of this. It depends really on the political momentum. Courts sometimes avoid constitutional issues between president and Congress, saying that this is a political question, we're not going to rule on it. And that's what I think you have here. If there ends up being enough political momentum, the Congress could decide that regardless of what the White House thinks, it, the Congress, has the power to decide whether there can be domestic surveillance without court warrants. And it could pass a law either authorizing the president to do so or restricting his ability to do so, and in either case asserting Congress's right to have some sort of say in this matter. That appears unlikely because of the majority Republican support for the president's interpretation that he has the right to do this on his own. There also, of course, would be created a sort of legislative record which courts then might refer to should court cases come up later on that would go to the question of what was Congress's intent when they passed the authorization to use military force after 9/11 and interpreting some of these constitutional issues. But really, it's not as though there's going to be a final ruling, if you will, from Congress on the legality. There's going to be a debate about it, but it's still going to come down to votes.
Fascinating run-up to these hearings, the Bush administration refusing requests from members of the Senate Judiciary Committee for classified legal opinions about this very program. Did they ever come through with those? Is Congress ever going to see those?
They have not, and Senator Leahy of Vermont, the ranking Democrat on the committee, said that since the whole issue of the committee is the issues of legality surrounding the warrantless surveillance of targets inside the U.S., that it was essential that the committee see the legal arguments internal to the Justice Department. Chairman Specter said that the precedent has been for those sort of internal legal arguments not to be made public, not to be given to committees. However, there's a precedent working against the Bush administration, which is that going back to the debate on torture, on prisoner abuse, The administration had previously, on its own volition, made public some of its internal Justice Department memoranda. Some also had leaked, but the administration had made some of this material public, and so that sort of increases the pressure. But ultimately, again, it's a White House prerogative. We saw with Vice President Cheney and some of the documents concerning his meetings with energy officers that the White House has the final say. The White House won that court case.
Meanwhile, briefly, John, as far as we know, while the hearings have gone on, the surveillance goes on as well.
That's right. It's an ongoing program. It is reviewed and has been approved every 30 days by the president. And of course, it's one that the White House says is carefully targeted. The White House is trying, and the U.S. intelligence community is trying to convey the idea that this is not a sort of giant vacuum cleaner sweep of everybody's emails and phone calls, but since the details of this program remain highly classified, not even briefable to the full House and Senate intelligence committees, let alone the general public, it's hard to really get to ground truth on just how extensive the program is.
John Diamond, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
John Diamond, Washington correspondent for USA Today. Let's get the sound of these hearings in our ear. Senator Patrick Leahy came on after Arlen Specter opened the hearings this morning. This is the Judiciary Committee's ranking Democrat from Vermont, saying nobody is above the law.
We are the duly elected representatives of the United States. It's our duty to determine whether the laws of the United States have been violated. The President and the Justice Department have a constitutional duty to faithfully execute the laws. They do not write the laws. They do not pass the laws. They do not have unchecked powers to decide what laws to follow, and they certainly don't have the power to decide what laws to ignore. They cannot violate the laws or the rights of ordinary Americans. Mr. Attorney General, in America, our America, nobody is above the law, not even the President of the United States.
Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, in a moment we'll hear from the opening comments of Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Joining me right now in the studio is Julian Zelizer, professor of history at Boston University. He's author of On Capitol Hill and The American Congress. His forthcoming book on the history of national security politics is Thunder from the Right. Julian Zelizer, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from New York is Michael Dorff, law professor at Columbia University. He is co-author of On Reading the Constitution. His forthcoming book is No Litmus Test, Law and Politics in the 21st Century. Michael Dorff, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
We're going to hear a lot from these hearings today, but Michael Dorff, if I may, go first to you. What is at stake? What is on the table as these hearings roll out today?
Well, in terms of the legal issues, there are really three. The first question is whether the Constitution absolutely prohibits what the president has done without a warrant, and that's under the Fourth Amendment. The second question is whether the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, prohibits what the president has done here. And then the third question is a constitutional question, which is even if FISA does prohibit what the president has done, does he have the inherent authority to authorize these warrantless wiretaps and other forms of surveillance, notwithstanding the act? The defenders of the president's action have said this is an inherent executive prerogative, and so he can do it notwithstanding anything that Congress has said. So in some sense, Senator Leahy is right. The question is whether the president is above the law. But in a technical sense, the question really here is what is the law? What does the Constitution say? What do these statutes say? Finally, there's a sort of non-legal question hovering over all of this, which is that if you sort of read between the lines of what the president and Attorney General Gonzalez have said, they seem to say even if what we have done is illegal, it's justified, hearkening back to a line by President Lincoln who during the Civil War asked whether all the laws but one, meaning all the laws but habeas corpus provision, had to be thrown by the wayside just to preserve this one law. So it's a question in some sense of whether there's a power in the president to disobey the law. I don't think you'll hear Attorney General Gonzalez or any of the other members of the administration put it quite that way because they want to say that they're complying with the law. But I think at some level that's really what's at stake.
We'll hear from Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez in just a moment. But Julian Zelizer, at stake, are we talking here about potentially redefining the separation of powers or putting a new kind of brackets around it, busting boundaries or not?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, whenever this country has gone to war in the 20th century and in the 19th century, this issue has come up. The problem of presidential power is a great problem in American politics. And right now, the president is arguing, implicitly or explicitly, we're not just concerned about the law, but there are hints that we can go beyond the law if necessary in this war. And that would be a pretty big reinterpretation or pushing existing concepts of presidential power to new limits.
Let's listen in to the very beginning of the hearing when Arlen Specter had more to say about what was at stake here concerning the legality of the surveillance system.
We will be examining the administration's contention that notwithstanding the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, there is statutory authority for what the president has done by virtue of the resolution of Congress authorizing the use of force against the terrorists. I have already expressed myself as being skeptical of that interpretation, but I believe the administration is entitled to a full and fair opportunity to advance their legal case on that important issue.
And then Alberto Gonzalez before the committee saying that critics notwithstanding, and of course just yesterday, Senator Specter called the administration's argument here strained and unrealistic. The attorney general said we've got to use every tool available to fight in the war on terrorism, including surveillance.
To fight this unconventional war while remaining open and vibrantly engaged with the world, we must search out the terrorists abroad and pinpoint their cells here at home. To succeed, we must deploy not just soldiers and sailors and airmen and Marines. We must also depend on intelligence analysts, surveillance experts, and the nimble use of our technological strength.
Julian, you know the history here. Alberto Gonzalez writing today in the Wall Street Journal, he said, look, the day after Pearl Harbor, FDR authorized the interception of all communications traffic into and out of the United States. Point he's making, this is war. This is what presidents do. Get off our back.
He's correct. I mean, in that FDR was involved in these kind of intercepts, and so are all the presidents after him. But that was all before 1978, and that's the question. 1978 was a response to those revelations.
That is the passage of the Foreign Intelligence and Surveillance Act.
Exactly, and the whole point of that was to put some limits and restraints on what presidents could or could not do. So the question isn't, did presidents do this, or should presidents do this? The question is, what's legal for a president to do right now in this year?
Alberto Gonzalez speaking to presidential precedent here before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Let's listen.
Presidents throughout our history have authorized a warrantless surveillance of the enemy during wartime, and they have done so in ways far more sweeping than the narrowly targeted terrorist surveillance program authorized by President Bush. General Washington, for example, instructed his army to intercept letters between British operatives, copy them, and then allow those communications to go on their way. President Lincoln used a warrantless wiretapping of telegraph messages during the Civil War to discern the movements and intentions of opposing troops.
There it is, citing the precedent from Washington to Lincoln and writing today about FDR. We're joined now as well by Andrew McCarthy. He's from Paterson, New Jersey. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. He's a contributing writer for the National Review Online, a former federal prosecutor. Andrew McCarthy, thanks very much for being with us.
How are you?
Well, the country paying a lot of attention, I think, to the hearings today. It looks like big issues on the line. You've heard Senator Leahy and others say the issue here is whether the president can operate outside the law. Julian Zelizer just pointing out that in past time of war, presidents have taken drastic steps, but saying FISA, the 1978 legislation passed by Congress, ruled that out, and that makes this a whole new kettle of fish. Do you agree, Andrew McCarthy?
No, I disagree quite strongly, in fact. Every administration, including the Carter administration, which actually acceded to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act in 1978, has taken the position that the act did nothing to eviscerate the president's inherent authority in matters of foreign intelligence collection or national security to conduct wiretapping or the type of surveillance that the NSA program, I think, in fact, is even more limited than what the president's actually allowed to do. And I find it very interesting to hear people contend that the administration's position is in any way novel. Walter Dellinger, as the head of the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department during the Clinton administration, categorically stated the administration's position that where the president believes that an enactment by Congress unconstitutionally limits his powers, he has the authority to defend his office and decline to abide by it. There isn't anything new or novel about this. This isn't just a Bush administration position. This is really an executive branch position that is supported by Supreme Court authority that goes back to the turn of the 20th century and Justice Department opinion, which has been undisturbed since about 1860.
Michael Dorff, here we are once again with this sense of a polarized conversation. I mean, Americans trying to judge whether the law and the Constitution are being followed here. Is there a weight of opinion on this? Is it do most people think he's within or outside the law, within the legal, the scholarly legal community, within or without the Constitution? What's your interpretation, Michael Dorff?
Well, I don't want to characterize the weight of scholarly opinion. As you can see, there are people of good faith on both sides. I would just point people who are interested to the text of the Constitution, which makes the president commander-in-chief but assigns the great bulk of war-regulating powers to Congress, including the following two: to make rules concerning captures on land and water, and to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. Now, I think it's important to distinguish two kinds of inherent authority. There is inherent authority to act as commander-in-chief where Congress has not yet spoken. So, for example, if Congress declared war but didn't say anything about how we were going to treat captured enemy soldiers, then the president would surely have the authority to prescribe rules for their treatment and what to do with them. However, if Congress had passed a law prescribing rules concerning their capture, for example, prohibiting their torture, then the president would be bound by that. Likewise, where Congress has not acted regarding how we go about gathering intelligence, then the president certainly has inherent authority to go about intercepting wartime communications by the enemy. But if Congress has drawn certain lines, that seems to me to fall pretty clearly within the language of making rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. I don't quite understand how it is that the defenders of the president's conduct here can conflate these two different kinds of inherent authority. Perhaps Andrew can enlighten us.
Well, let's hear first directly from the Attorney General testifying this morning before the Senate Judiciary Committee on this point. Alberto Gonzalez said that the FISA law itself allowed for the president's surveillance program. Let's listen.
By its plain terms, FISA prohibits the government from engaging in electronic surveillance, quote, except as authorized by statute. Those words, except as authorized by statute, are no mere incident of drafting. Instead, they constitute a far-sighted safety valve. The Congress that passed FISA in 1978 included those words so that future Congresses could address unforeseen challenges. The 1978 Congress afforded future lawmakers the ability to modify or eliminate the need for a FISA application without having to amend or repeal FISA. Congress provided this safety valve because it knew that the only thing certain about foreign threats is that they change in unpredictable ways. Mr. Chairman, the resolution authorizing the use of military force is exactly the sort of later statutory authorization contemplated by FISA safety valve.
Andrew McCarthy, give us some interpretation here. What he's saying is that Congress left open a safety valve and that the authorization to apply military force that came just after 9/11 is such a statute that clears the way. How does that read to you, Mr. McCarthy?
Well, I think this is really the position that the administration has been taking for, I guess, about 6 weeks since this all erupted in mid-December. The use of force authorization right after 9/11 is broad and sweeping, and it includes, the Supreme Court has suggested in the Hamdi case, all of the fundamental incidents of waging war. The penetration of enemy communication is such a fundamental incident, and given that it is provided for in the authorization, I think the position that the administration has taken, even though it's been attacked by some, is a very plausible reading of the use of force authorization. That is, that implicitly it allows the or supports the notion that the administration may engage in this kind of signals intelligence, just as the administration found that, or the Supreme Court rather found in the Hamdi case, that that the capturing and detaining of American citizens as unlawful enemy combatants was included implicitly in the use of force resolution, even though it wasn't spelled out explicitly.
Michael Dorff, we have any number of folks on Capitol Hill, members of Congress, saying this isn't what we intended. Senator Spector himself saying it's a strained and unrealistic interpretation that the White House is giving here. Is it possible that the Congress authorized the president to do something without even knowing it, that in that clause, the authorization's there, whether the Congress was conscious or deliberate in leaving that opening or not?
No. Section 1811 of FISA says that in the event that Congress declares war, then the president, notwithstanding FISA, may, without a court order, engage in electronic surveillance for a period of up to 15 days. So it's undoubtedly true that if we treat the joint resolution of September 18, 2001, as the equivalent of a declaration of war, the president had the authority to engage in warrantless surveillance for 15 days. If that wasn't enough, he could have gone back to Congress to get the specific statutory authorization. I think it's absurd to claim, as the Attorney General does, that when you have this specific language as except as authorized by statute, and then this other language referring to a general declaration of war, that you can treat a general declaration of war as the kind of authorization by statute that Congress had in mind in the original FISA. I should say, in fairness, one could read the joint resolution as displacing FISA, but then it seems to me it displaces virtually all of the prior congressional acts regarding war, including some of the ones that the Supreme Court relied on in Hamdi to find that there was authorization for military commissions. So I just don't think that it's a plausible reading of FISA to say that authorization by statute includes a broad declaration of war, when FISA itself tells us a broad declaration of war only gives you authority to do this for 15 days.
We're looking at today's hearings on NSA surveillance ordered by President Bush. Linda is calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Linda. What do you think?
I have three concerns. Is it constitutional? Is it legal? But most important, has he gone too far? If you believe that the founders were most concerned about a strong executive and wanted a stronger Congress, then the answer to the first two is it's not constitutional, it's not legal. But we can answer the third one, has he gone too far? Because since we have no judicial oversight, we have only his word that he's not spying on political enemies, that he's not spying on people who disagree with him. And we don't know that, and we know that historically he has lied, and we know that historically Richard Nixon lied, and that's why FISA was passed.
So what are you hoping might come out of hearings on Capitol Hill, Linda?
I have virtually no hope that this Congress will do anything, since they seem to put partisan loyalty above the interest of the country. But I am very concerned that he is not just spying on terrorists or people connected to terrorists, but that he is actually spying on people who disagree with him politically.
But as you say, we don't have the kind of FISA record of what's going on here, so that is that's a blind. Linda, thanks for your call. Julian Zelizer, what about it? On the one hand, Congress is saying, we have some saying this is going too far. On the other hand, Andrew McCarthy and yourself point out that in history, presidents have gone far in time of war. So are we looking here at expanding the power of the presidency with a precedent set by what's going on, or potentially, though Linda and others say they have little hope of this, potentially reining it in if the Congress did something to block this?
Well, I mean, we have to see which way it goes. I think you asked earlier, what's the point of these hearings? And I think it's not just Congress will give us an answer, A or B. Mm-hmm. I think it's to create this public discussion. That's one of the most healthy functions of these hearings. In the 70s, they opened up this whole debate. Frank Church's hearings opened up. He was a member of Congress who started investigating, what is the NSA doing? Why is the government looking into domestic opposition groups? And I think now it's uncertain. And I think one of the things the public will have to enter in and weigh in on the debate, and that's what can come out of these hearings.
But is discussion, healthy discussion, as you put it, enough here? I mean, precedents will presumably be established by whether or not this rolls forward or this is stopped.
Absolutely. I mean, look, if nothing is done, the precedent will be set. And I don't think there will be any break on the president for at least continuing this program, if not expanding it, and Americans will live by that.
Let's listen in again. Here's Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez talking about the Hamdi case and the Supreme Court ruling there.
Justice O'Connor explained that these traditional powers include the right to detain enemy combatants and to do so even if they happen to be American citizens. If the detention of an American citizen who fought with Al-Qaeda is authorized by the force resolution as an incident of waging war, how can it be that merely listening to Al-Qaeda phone calls into and out of the country in order to disrupt their plots is not?
Andrew McCarthy, take us to the Hamdi case and what you hear the Attorney General arguing right there.
Well, I think he's obviously drawing an analogy, Tom, between the between what are fundamental incidents of war, that is the capturing and detention of enemy combatants and the penetration of enemy communications. It's important, I think, that he do that because war obviously is not a it's not an open ticket, it's not a blank check for a president, and in order to make a cogent or compelling argument that these steps that the administration has taken are measured ones within the proper parameters of presidential authority, that they do come within the executive and commander-in-chief powers in wartime, and that they are traditional elements of waging war. I think once you get beyond what people would agree are traditional elements of engaging in warfare, then you have a real problem justifying robust executive actions.
The issues are just about as big as they get, may end up setting new precedents, new expectations of how a president can act. Presidents have acted before, as you heard Julian Zelizer say, in war, but this is, as President Bush now calls it, and the new Pentagon documents call it, the long war. Mel is calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Mel, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just do not understand all the paranoia behind this. We're not fighting a war with a country. We're fighting a war with certain individuals who are intent on causing great damage. And I think, as President Bush succinctly put it, if we have people here talking to Al-Qaeda, we need to know about it.
I think the government
and the Congress should be spending more time on diplomacy, working the issues to resolve all the conflicts that we've created around the world now.
But do you see any problem with the current law, the FISA law, in knowing when people are talking to Al-Qaeda? Do you think the president
I personally have no issue with that at all. I don't do anything wrong. If it can find one person that can stop a terrorist act, congratulations, President Bush.
And off you go. Mel, thanks for your call. Julian Zelizer. The implication I get from you, and maybe Mel's call feeds into this, is that ultimately it's about what the public will accept.
Yeah, I think that's a big issue here. I mean, we've talked a lot about the legal precedents, what they are, what's being set, but there's the political precedent. That's what Congress is traditionally interested in whenever we examine this issue over the centuries. What will the public tolerate and what won't they tolerate? And we want to ask what Mel was raising. What's okay, especially in this new war? And I don't think it's a set answer at this point.
Michael Dorf, is it your sense that this sort of sweeping authority to come in and do what's being done is necessary? What we're hearing from Arlen Specter and others is, Mr. President, if you want this power, come to us. We'll give it to you. But let's keep it within understanding that we have a role and you have a role. Is it necessary to go outside those bounds?
It's very difficult to know whether the program that the administration is conducting is necessary because perhaps for valid national security reasons, we don't know any of the details of the program. Now, that doesn't mean that it's necessary to do it without seeking congressional authorization. Congress could repeal or suspend FISA for some period of time and give the president this authority without disclosing what it is that specifically he's doing. So the question here is not, I think, ultimately whether one trusts the president versus the courts or even the Congress, but rather should the president at the very least consult with Congress, get some authorization. My suspicion here is that the reason they didn't want to go to Congress is because this administration, more so than any in recent memory, the closest one in recent years is the Reagan administration, this administration believes very strongly in the prerogatives of the presidency, and they don't want to be seen to be asking Congress for permission for doing something they think they have the right to do anyway. Now, I acknowledge that the public doesn't really care, and perhaps rightly, about these separation of powers questions.
Are you so sure of that? I mean, maybe Mel doesn't, maybe others don't, but in general, Americans are taught in civics class about separation of powers as something quite important.
Well, I don't mean they don't care about separation of powers. What I mean is that people are going to evaluate this based on the question of whether they think they're willing to trade off some of their privacy for added security. And what I think people need to understand, maybe they do understand, and you're right, is that we have certain mechanisms, namely separation of powers, so that Congress authorizes the courts oversee, precisely to ensure that the trade-offs that the public is willing to accept are the ones that are made, rather than ones that the administration, in its zeal to fight terrorism, protect the country, is going to make and strike a very different balance.
So in today's hearings, we've got Senator Arlen Specter asking Attorney General Gonzalez why the administration did not take their surveillance plan to the courts, to the FISA courts, which have been very cooperative and very tight-lipped about the surveillance in the past, but have been obviously within the bounds of that legislation. Here's Attorney General Gonzalez's response and a bit of the exchange.
We studied very carefully what FISA provides for. As I said in my statement, we believe that FISA does anticipate that another statute could permit electronic surveillance.
Okay, you think you're right, but there are a lot of people who think you're wrong. As a matter of public confidence, why not take it to the FISA court? What do you have to lose if you're right?
What I can say, Senator, is that we are continually looking at ways that we can work with the FISA court in being more efficient and more effective in fighting the war on terror. Obviously, we would consider and are always considering methods of fighting the war effectively against al-Qaeda.
Well, speaking for myself, I would urge the president to take this matter to the FISA court.
Andrew McCarthy, speak to just this point in this exchange. What's your interpretation of why the White House has not gone to the FISA court with this? It would satisfy basically everybody. FISA's been working reportedly pretty well for a long time now. Is it a technical or logistical issue that going to FISA would interrupt the surveillance that the administration feels is necessary, even though it allows, you know, you can come back to them days later for the warrant that you might need? Or is it a matter of principle that the White House simply wants to assert, in the sort of Dick Cheney mold, a more powerful presidency?
Well, I think, you know, there are two different aspects of this. This administration has used FISA more than any other administration in history, so I don't think it's got a preternatural resistance to the use of FISA.
But it's resisting right now. I mean,
well, no, it may well be that this program under the parameters of FISA would not work, either because the coverage of it is sufficiently expansive that the approvals that FISA requires, even for the post-listening notification 72 hours mm-hmm. later, wouldn't work, or else the standard is too high. That is, that it's a probable cause standard. The administration says that it's using a reasonable basis standard, which it says is functionally at least almost equivalent to probable cause.
So the first case you posit there is that they're scooping up so much data, so many voices and emails that FISA couldn't handle it?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm not saying that they're scooping up so many. Let me put it this way: by the time they get content, as I understand it, they have already identified that at least one person on the end of the phone is an al-Qaeda person. So it's not an indiscriminate sweeping up of voice and content of communications, but I do think that
there's some question about that. But yeah.
If they have 7,000 to 75 people under coverage at one time, that's an extraordinary amount of information. Given the fact that, you know, with the FISA regime, what you're generally talking about, I don't know what the figures are off the top of my head, but I think it's never been more than, like, you know, somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 applications a year. And now you're talking about something that's six or seven times that on a daily basis. That would be an extraordinary workload, even assuming you could meet the evidentiary standard.
And yet, why not crank up those courts rather than bring into question the separation of powers and the constitutional crisis some have called?
Well, I think that, you know, that's a interesting question to ask under circumstances where we have their provisions in the Patriot Act, which are far less controversial than this FISA surveillance, that we can't get Congress to sign off on and re-up and renew. And that's the reason why we've just last Friday, I think, had to have another six-week extension while they iron out the Patriot Act. So I find it surprising to hear the suggestion out there that if the administration had only just gone to Congress, we could have fixed FISA in a jiffy, and then we could have made this program completely legal within the FISA framework. And I do think that, coming back to the question of separation of powers, if you accept the premise, and I realize that this is a controversial premise, that there is a reservoir of executive authority under which this is legal, you don't really need to open up the whole can of worms about trying to fix FISA and all of the partisan and technical problems that you would have to deal with in that kind of endeavor.
Julian Zelizer, what's your interpretation of why the president's not simply going to Congress? Our inspector saying, come on, we've signed off on a lot here. We could sign off for some more. Talk to us.
I think it's much deeper than the last comment suggested. I think many members in the administration cut their teeth in politics in the 1970s. Dick Cheney was working for President Ford, and if you look at the archives, if you look at the record, this is a generation of politicians who resisted congressional prerogatives on national security issues. They were frustrated with FISA. They didn't think this was a good move for the country. And this goes back many decades at this point. So I think it's much bigger than that. I don't think they think Congress should have much of a role or can have much of a role in handling national security. And it's playing out with this FISA.
So we really are looking here at how we carve our understanding of powers. Let's listen here to an exchange between Senator Patrick Leahy and the Attorney General, Gonzalez. Leahy continuing his questioning on when the administration decided it had the authority to begin the surveillance program.
So your answer is you did not come to that conclusion before the Senate passed a resolution on September 14, 2001?
Sir, I certainly had not come to that conclusion. There may be others in the administration who did.
Were you aware of anybody in the administration that came to that conclusion before September 14, 2001?
Senator, sitting here right now, I don't have any knowledge of that.
Were you aware of anybody coming to that conclusion before the president signed the resolution on September 18, 2001?
No, Senator. The only thing that I can recall is that we had just been attacked and that we had been attacked by an enemy from within our own borders.
Attorney General, I understand. I was here when that attack happened.
Right.
And I joined with Republicans and Democrats and virtually every member of this Congress to try to give you the tools that you said you needed for us to go after al-Qaeda, and especially to go after Osama bin Laden, the man that we all understood masterminded the attack and the man who's still at large.
You feel the frustration right there between Senator Patrick Leahy and the Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Leahy asking about September 14th, 2001, that the date of Congress giving the authorization for use of military force. Him asking, did this surveillance begin even before that? Getting to exactly where the origin of this was. Bill is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, how are y'all?
We're well. We're well.
I'm a lifelong Republican. I voted for Bush both times.
Mm-hmm.
I have some regrets now. And a simple question. Why do they not have to go before a judge if they suspect that someone is involved in activities of this sort, someone individual or a specific group? It's what police departments all over the United States have to do. You don't have to go to court. All you have to do is appear before the judge. And if there's reasonable suspicion, judges grant that power out of hand. Why doesn't the government have to do the same thing?
But, Bill, and we understand exactly where that question comes from, straight out of the U.S. Constitution. But you're hearing today in the hearings and from our guest, Andrew McCarthy, saying it may not be practicable. You're hearing from our guest, Julian Zelizer, saying maybe this White House just doesn't want that kind of oversight. Maybe they believe Congress has grabbed too much power since the 60s and 70s.
I think they're seeking this carte blanche abusive right, and I think that there needs to be that type of oversight, just like every other investigation everywhere else has to do, and I think it's a double standard. I'll take my y'all's response off the air.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Michael Dorff, part of what is at the root of this debate is whether or not the country should be responding to this challenge as though it's a criminal issue or a war issue. And if it's war, as the White House says, then maybe there's more latitude.
I think that's a fair point, and this is why the Supreme Court has said that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply certainly to completely foreign surveillance in wartime. There really are two fundamental questions here. One is, why doesn't the administration want to go to the courts? And if the answer is because it's too cumbersome, because the standard is too difficult, because we have too many cases and not enough judges, or whatever the answer is, the question then is, well, why not go to Congress to get the authorization? And I should say, if the answer is, well, because Congress isn't going to give it to us, that seems to me to be a very frightening answer. It's an answer that says the president can do whatever he wants. He can go to Congress when Congress is going to tell him what he wants to hear, but not when it's going to stand up to him. That's not about this president or this Congress. That's about the fundamental separation of powers. And I think the caller may be right, may be wrong about the need to go to a judge in ordinary criminal cases and the applicability of that to foreign surveillance. But he's coming back to sort of fundamentals. It's what you referred to earlier as the civics class version of our Constitution, which many people are quite enamored of, quite rightly. And I don't think we've heard answers to that. All that Attorney General Gonzalez says is, we're fighting a war against bad guys. Everybody agrees we're fighting a war against bad guys. The question is, how are we going to fight that war and who's going to make those decisions?
I don't say civics class version disparagingly. I think that's
No, I agree.
That's the Constitution. Let's get one more call. Charles is calling from Thompson, Georgia. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
It all comes down to me to the question of trust. And, you know, he's been left untruthful before. And I just don't trust him, especially with, you know, people, his advisors like Karl Rove and that bunch. I just don't have a good feeling about it at all.
So it comes down to trust. Our time is short, but we hear you're not happy with that. Andrew McCarthy, what about it? There's any number of staunch conservatives now out there saying, wait a minute, as conservatives, we don't want to be asked to put this much simple trust in government. We've got a constitution and a system of laws that's supposed to bring transparency. Don't ask us to trust in this way. Is that an unreasonable response, Mr. McCarthy?
I think in a lot of ways it is, although it's not one that can be removed from the equation. You know, ultimately, the president, no matter who the president is, and no matter whether we agree with him or not most of the time or all of the time, the president has a lot of power, and if you find the president ultimately untrustworthy, then that's going to be problematic in your view of what the president's policies are. And if you find him trustworthy, I suppose it goes the other way. The interesting thing to me is that all of the focus that we've had, including the fact that the first hearing that we're having today is in the Judiciary Committee rather than the Intelligence Committee, suggest that we've gotten ourselves really focused and perhaps even obsessed on the legalities of all this when the bottom line question really probably is, does it work or not? Because if all this is really keeping us safer, I think people have one view of it. If it's not, then, you know, one wonders whether the energy that we're expending on the esoterica of the hinterland of the Fourth Amendment and FISA is really all worth it.
I don't know if the Fourth Amendment and FISA are hinterlands or not. The question of effectiveness, well,
I didn't mean to suggest that they're completely hinterlands. I mean that we're really in the margins of it.
And with the lack of transparency about what's going on, going to be very difficult to judge. We're going to come back tomorrow and look at the hearings and the outcome. I want to thank my guests for being with us today. Andrew McCarthy in Paterson, New Jersey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Dorff, law professor at Columbia University, thank you very much for your observations today.
My pleasure.
And Julian Zelizer, great to have you as always. Thanks so much for coming on. We're going to keep an eye on this. Thanks for being here, Julian.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.